The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Well, good morning, everyone. First, I wanted to express appreciation to all of you who were yesterday out providing good examples of free speeching and free assembling for the benefit of all. And to the dads, being good examples. I'm not going to be a dad in this lifetime. But I sure do appreciate them. The Times did a thing this morning where they had children of dads send in their texts that they'd received from their dads. Very nice, sweet. I could have used a few of those from mine. And on the other side, one of the late night hosts stopped dads with their children walking down the street in New York City and asked them complicated questions like, when was your child born? What are the names of their friends? What's the name of the school they go to? Not very encouraging. Really. So, but there's always room for more, for better. I wanted to talk this morning about Buddhist study. During the last Ango, we were looking at the eight gates. Gokhan Osho did a nice mando on Buddhist study, and I wanted to take it up and do a little bit with it as well. It is one of the areas of training that we do, and in the Zen tradition, Zen has for hundreds of years described itself as a special transmission outside the scriptures, the sutras, the sacred teachings, not relying on words and letters, a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of enlightenment. So very clearly making a statement about the relationship with the spoken word, even the teachings, the sutras themselves. And so then why is the role of Buddhist study in our training and just in the tradition of Buddhism as practitioners? And I want to say at the outset that there are different views on this in different schools of Buddhism, different lineages, and particularly with different teachers. And I tend to think that that arises, you know, both from the emphasis within that teacher's particular school or lineage, but also, maybe most importantly, from their own experience. You know, what was, as they were training, as they were developing, as they were awakening their mind, what elements of their training and of the practice and the various forms of practice and teachings were particularly important to them, and which of those were not? And that's sort of naturally going to come into the way they present the Dharma. So there are teachers and lineages that feel like a relationship, very important, a close, intimate relationship with Buddhist study and studying the Dharma, studying the teachings, the texts is essential, and other teachers that don't feel that strongly or that way. So just to sort of make that clear. And so I thought a way to look at this, because we could think of Buddhist study as just, well, you study the teachings. Every practitioner does that. You know, oftentimes that's how we encounter Buddhism, is through a text or a book. And we've all, you know, if we're literate, then we have read, and we've read books before, so here's another one that is a Dharma book, and for some reason it affects us, we hear it, it resonates, and maybe we begin to explore. So what else is there? Well, let's look at that a little bit. What else is there? In Bill Waldron's book on the making sense of Yogacara, which really is a school of Buddhism, very important in Zen, that really studies the mind, the nature of mind, the different levels of consciousness, how we experience and perceive and what we do with that. And he says, to survive, every being needs to distinguish one thing from another. He talks about just a single cell organism that has to decide what will it allow through its interface, its cell wall, what's food and what's toxic to it. So even a single cell organism is discriminating, right? Its environment, its world. So it has to distinguish different things. And our sense faculties work in a similar way. We define, he said, we virtually define what counts, you know, as we perceive it, by how we perceive it. He says our faculties respond categorically. We experience pitches as high or low, wavelength as red or blue. And it seems as though these come already structured, right? We see something, we don't think, well, should that be high or should that be low? We just experience it, as he says, in a sense, categorically structured. And then as we develop what he calls these proto-categorizations, these sort of primitive sort of ways of relating to differences within our world, become worked into our nervous system, integrated. So at a very deep level, something is happening. So new sensory stimuli coming in are experienced from that, from within that structure that's already been built or is being built. It interacts with us and it allows us to recognize this object and to do that quickly, right? So you think in terms of evolution that we need to quickly discern whether this is friendly, a friend or foe, right? Is this a threat or is this food? And we can't dilly-dally, right? We need to know right away. And so that's sort of built into our system. And that's understood in Buddhism. It's called apperception. It has its own Sanskrit name, which is the recognition of the characteristics of something. So when you come across the word signs, the signs in Buddhism means the qualities, the attributes, the characteristics, how you recognize this being different from that. And that we begin to do that automatically, right? It's not a conscious thing. And so he says, and then he says, our linguistic operations, our languaging, operates in similar ways in the sense that it functions to distinguish things. So our language does that. Nouns, you know, define objects and define one object different from another. And those depend upon what he calls neurologically embedded categories formed through experience, right? So we learn language. That's part of our growing up, and it's an essential part of our growing up. How to speak is not just how to form a word, but it's how to relate a word to an object or to an action. And he says this also begins to operate almost unconsciously and automatically. He says we cannot choose to not understand a word in our native language. So when we hear a word, we automatically understand what the meaning of that is. It's already built in. We can't not do that. He says, nor can we readily recognize how much our vocabulary and syntax shape our worldview, especially if we only speak one language and we've really only experienced one culture. You know, then we tend to think, well, that's just the world, the way the world is everywhere, right? As it's expressed through our language. He says, but language is different. Also, because it's constructed, right? We're not born speaking. Just had an image of an embryo, somebody at birth, you know, a little baby being born and starting to talk, you know. That'd be a little scary. So language is clearly created, and it is created by us, by human beings. And it's evolved over time. And of course, its function is social interaction, right? If we were by ourselves, there would be no need for language. And words don't mean anything in and of themselves. I mean, Buddhism understands this, that they are fundamentally empty of any meaning, inherently. So the teachings say, when I say the word fire, my mouth doesn't burn, right? So there's nothing intrinsically hot in the word fire. It refers to something that we describe as hot. And also, words don't convey meaning in isolation. They require social context, right? Words have meaning within a social system, a social structure, in a sense, within a social agreement. And they require syntax. Words mean different things in different situations, when they're used differently. Words evolve over time to mean different things. So they don't, again, have a fixed meaning. He says, it's easy, though, to imagine that the names we give to things refer to specific things. So think about a relationship with naming something. What is that? It's a chair. Oh, now I know what it is, right? So the way that we sort of immediately assume that when I know the name of someone or something, that I know something intrinsic about that thing. But he goes on to say that we generally use what he calls class nouns. So a chair can refer to many, many different things, right? And that's very convenient. He said if we have to have a proper noun for every single object in the world, that would be difficult, right? So we have words that cover whole classes of things, like a person, people, man, woman. He says this means that we depend on words and concepts as mental extensions of our senses. How intricate, how inextricable language is from our consciousness and perception. And this is why the Buddha said that the world is your mind, is your senses. And that doesn't mean that we are literally creating the world, right? That when I die, the world will cease to exist, but it will cease to exist for me. I will no longer perceive the world. And so in that way, I create the world that I know, that I am perceiving in every moment. And so what if the ways in which I am perceiving are cloudy, are biased, right, are deluded, are permeated by anger and false views? That's the world I experience. And because it's so automatic and integrated into this system, I don't know that. I don't see my mind projecting an internal experience onto the world outside. I just think that's just the world. I see it objectively. And so in Buddhism, the recognition that our mind proliferates, right, that we experience something, then the words come to mind, and the mind seizes on those words and it proliferates, it creates concepts and ideas. And so Bill says, so the paradox we labor under is that the very tools by which we know the world are the same tools by which we are blinded to the world, through the words and the concepts and the ideas and the beliefs. And so when we think back about that statement attributed to Bodhidharma, of not relying on the sutras, that even the sutras themselves could blind us to the very thing the sutras are pointing at. How could that happen? So another scholar talking about Buddhism said that language, just to acknowledge also that language influences our conscious experience, and that words relate to something, to an activity, to an object, to ourselves. And he says the most natural and simple conclusion would be that the structure of language is simply a faithful reflection of the objective reality. Words are just an accurate description of the world itself. He said, however, it may also be the other way around. The content of our ordinary consciousness In other words, the way we experience things may have been processed or created, cultivated, evolved to possess a particular structure exactly in order for us to be able to express it linguistically. That's an interesting idea, right? Has our mind evolved to perceive the world so that we can name it? And to name it in a way is to domesticate it, control it, put it in a box, make it knowable, limit it. And maybe that's just a way of trying to deal with our deepest anxiety about being in this vast and boundless world that we cannot control, right? That we don't fully understand as a finite being that is going to die. And so how do we meet that anxiety that we may not even know we carry? So he says, we are, after all, social beings, and communicating by the medium of language is crucial for our survival. So perhaps that's how our minds evolved, so that we could speak, so that we could be social beings, so that we could survive. But that means survive together. It doesn't mean we evolved to be social beings to survive and ultimately be alone. It means to survive together. He said, it's interesting how many of these scholars are drawing on neuroscience and the sciences of the mind to basically confirm, in many most cases, what the Buddha taught centuries ago. He said, experiments show that language influences perception. Buddhism already knew that, but at the preconscious and non-linguistic level, there are good reasons to think that language plays an important role in the construction of our experience of the world. Therefore, if our consciousness of the world is dependent on the structure of language that we use, then we are bound to cognize it, to know it, as consisting of separate entities, because that's what language does. It separates things. This is the chair. This is the book. Right? This is Shugen. This is Gokan. We are bound to cognize it as consisting of separate entities which are separated from other entities by rigid boundaries and which are the vehicles of certain qualities and agents or objects or actions. So now, when we come back to the question of study, is it just a simple matter of reading words on a page, gathering in the information, and knowing a little bit more about Buddhism? Is there something happening at a much deeper level that is meeting something that has already been happening at a much deeper level, because we've been thinking and speaking and having ideas and concepts since the beginning of our lives? So I was thinking as I was working on this that, you know, Buddhist study, I've never been entirely, Dada Roshi actually used to refer to it as academic study, which I had an opinion about. I didn't like that, because like I didn't want to study Buddhism academically. And so I don't remember if he changed that or I changed that. It changed. So Buddhist study. But I was thinking as I was working on this, really it's Dharma study. I mean, there are times in which our study is the study of Buddhism. It's history, it's evolution, different schools, and so on. But ultimately for me, even if I'm reading about the history, I mean, to me that's interesting because of what I've done with my life, but ultimately, it's also interesting in terms of how people evolved within the Dharma over centuries. So to me, it's never ultimately of interest because it's just academic or intellectual, but how does it all relate back to lives and practice? And so we can think of, if we think of study on happening on two levels, one is understanding, developing understanding. So the Buddha said right view is the first of the Eightfold Path. And he often talked about that as understanding the Four Noble Truths. Just having a basic understanding of what the Four Noble Truths, which is one of the first is said to be the first real teaching of the Buddha, a foundational teaching that all conditioned things are dukkha. Dukkha arises out of our thirst, our craving, our grasping. That because that is something that we are actively engaged in, that can come to cessation, we can liberate ourselves, and that there is a path by which we can do that, the Noble Path, Eightfold Path. And so we study the teachings of the Four Noble Truths to try and understand what each of those is pointing to, because those, the point of that teaching is to bring that back into our practice, to recognize, I mean, that's actually the teaching, is to understand and recognize dukkha. Oh, I see, right. Disappointment, dissatisfaction, suffering, fear, confusion, all the stuff that I see moving within myself. So it's not an abstract, it's just recognizing something that I now see more clearly. To recognize and begin to relinquish my grasping. So the point of the teaching is to actually, you could say, implement it, bring it into practice. As Buddhism has become more, well, I don't know where it is now, but in the time when it was went from being really an outlier kind of thing, on the fringe, to becoming more brought into popular culture, mainstream, there was a period of time where we were getting calls all the time from news agencies, ABC, and newspapers who wanted to do stories about this thing called Buddhism. It was a happening thing, right? That's not happening anymore. Right, I knew it would, you know, because that's what happens. Something comes into fashion, it's an item, and then it fades. Which I think is probably a good thing for Buddhism. It's no longer a news item. But in that process of being brought into people's homes and popularized, it undergoes a change. Buddhism, well, the Dharma doesn't undergo a change, but people's understanding of it changes. The way Buddhism might be taught can undergo a change as it becomes popular, because in order to be popular, it has to be essentially made easier, more accessible. It has to be put into language that is easier to understand, that doesn't require the careful, slow, patient, contemplative, sometimes difficult study that true study requires, because we're studying something that is profound. And that thing that is profound is you, your mind, your consciousness, your karma. So that doesn't, you know, you can't put that into a soundbite. And so it gets sort of spread out. And so to think about these terms that are used in Buddhism that we rely upon as practitioners to understand clearly, because they're so important, because they're really pointing to these key, foundational, fundamental aspects of both our suffering, the path itself, and how we liberate ourselves. So, dukkha, attachment, self, emptiness, mindfulness, non-duality, compassion, samadhi, insight, enlightenment, liberation, thusness. And what happens is these words, as they're brought more and more into more and more texts and books and magazines and even advertisements and TV shows and movies, is they become casualized, right? They become casual. They're used casually. So their depth, their profundity, their complexity gets lost, right? What they're pointing to is not lost, but the use of them becomes lost. And that's actually important, because for the practitioner, if they become that in our mind, that infects our practice. It affects. I said infect, and I meant that, but it also affects. It's infecting our consciousness, in a sense. It's influencing us. It's changing what we think we're doing, what we may think is possible, how to recognize what we're experiencing. And so it's not at all uncommon where people will come in and say, you know, I experienced this, or I experienced this, and I say, well, tell me more. And I'll say, well, no, actually, what you're experiencing is good. It's a good indication your practice is developing, but it's not what you just said. It's not emptiness. It's not thusness. It's not falling away of body and mind, right? But what you did experience has a value, right? So what happens in that kind of casualizing experience is we can be too quick to just say, oh, this is what they're talking about. And I think we need more humility to slow things down a little bit. And so what that means is we actually have to study and understand what do these single terms, these words mean, right? And that process is slow. And so when we're studying, if we're just, you know, you've got a bunch of books on your shelf and you want to get through them and you want to just keep turning the pages, that's not going to happen. We're just going to gloss over those terms and think, well, I have a basic idea of what that means. You know, I read what that means, but do we understand what it means in terms of what Buddhism says it means? That's really what we should want to know. Not what does it mean on the internet or what somebody told us, but what did the Buddha say it meant? What has it meant over the centuries as it's come down and been brought into people's lives and practice? And then we study the teachings, right? More language. We hear phrases. We hear things like, I alone am the honored one. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Ordinary mind is the way. The supreme way is not difficult if only you don't pick and choose. Because it is not a world, I call it the world. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. What is form? What does Buddhism mean when it uses that word? It's an English word. We know what it means in English. But what does Buddhism mean by that? What is emptiness? Right? I spent a long time, too long, imagining what emptiness meant. A big black hole, you know, dark night, no stars, you know, and trying to think, how is that me? Right? I didn't have just a basic good understanding of what emptiness meant. Ordinary mind, what is ordinary mind? That has a very particular meaning in the Zen tradition, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, because it is not a world. What is the world? So that's part of the deal with words being, these terms being translated from their Sanskrit or their Pali or their Chinese or their Tibetan, is that they're translated into English, which already has meaning, and in some way approximates what that word means, but is not exact. We should just assume it's never an exact translation. It's always partly right and partly wrong. And our job as practitioners is to clarify, right? Because that word then becomes part of my language that I speak of, that I think of, and becomes part of my relationship with the Dharma, my practice, my actual experience of what I'm doing when I'm sitting, for instance. And, you know, those teachings can very easily become cliches, which means they just become trivial, which is a terrible thing to do to anything, really. We study concepts like karma. We talked about this yesterday. Rebirth, dependent origination, different realms of existence, the three trainings, the three worlds. These are very deep, very profound concepts, you know, ways of looking at reality, how reality works, and to help us gain understanding so we understand how this works, how the mind works, so we can practice within that understanding skillfully. I mean, think about it. If a person thinks that Zazen is about not thinking and getting to a place of not thinking because that's calm, that's a state of concentration, they read that that's important. It's part of the Eightfold Path. And that's all I know. But it makes sense to me, and I have faith in that because, my mind's, you know, crazy and I want it to stop moving. So then I can go about just stopping my mind to get to that place that I think is what the Buddha is talking about, and basically ignore everything along the way, suppress it, deny it, push it out of the way, knock it down, and probably much of the time hate it, get frustrated, discouraged, and think that all the while the problem is that I don't have enough concentration. So I just need to bear down harder. And all the while, I can quite sincerely think that I'm doing Buddhist practice. And I'm not. I'm not developing mindfulness. I might have just passed by that altogether. I'm not developing concentration. That's not concentration in Buddhism. How would I know that? So that's why it's so important to study what do these very pregnant terms mean. And that takes time. I mean, I remember the first time I started reading about dependent origination, I was like, oh my God, this is so complicated. I didn't want it to be complicated, right? I wanted it to be immediately relevant, right? I wanted to be able to relate to it now, get something from it, right? A feeling of satisfaction. It's like, okay, I get this. I got it. And that then somehow, you know, that's going to help me. That's dangerous, right? Because it means we will not stay with certain aspects of the teachings that are going to be difficult. They're just going to be difficult. I mean, unless, I don't know, you're a prodigy or, you know, you have a particular, and then good. For you, it's not so difficult. But I think for many of us, it is. And so we have to persist. We have to stay with something. Sometimes I stayed with something or kept coming back to it, not because it made me feel good or I could relate to it. I wasn't. But I kept coming back to it because I kept, in my other studies, I kept coming across that concept or that teaching and being presented as something that was really important and really foundational, being spoken of from somebody that I respected. I was like, okay, I guess I really do need to understand this. If I want to, like, understand. And so, of course, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't be using Buddhist language. We need to, but to do so with self-knowing, self-awareness of what we do know and have confidence in and what we don't, and to really be okay with that. To really be okay with that. I mean, you know, if you could come in here wanting to resolve the question of life and death, and by the end of this morning, you'd realize it all? Could that be possible? Could that be anything of any depth, right? We know already that if there's something that has the potential to give us great, you know, to be a deep or broad or have, you know, a profound influence on our life, it's going to take some time. It's not going to be immediately accessible. And we apply ourselves in all kinds of things that take tremendous commitment and perseverance and constancy because it's important to us. And we know we cannot achieve that easily, quickly. We study the sutras, right? And then we come across language, which is ancient, and references to things that we may not understand. We come across sexism and misogyny. They can be very upsetting. We come across what's basically sort of inter-Buddhist politics. You know, one school speaking about another school, right? And so part of it is sort of how to handle, how to work with some of those things that are difficult, you know? And there's been excellent scholarship on some of that in terms of how can there possibly be sexism, misogyny in Buddhist sutras when the Buddha made it abundantly clear over and over that there is no distinction in gender. There's no distinction in monastic and lay. Everyone in our language has Buddha nature. Everyone has a potential, not only has a potential to enlighten their mind, but in the Buddha's time was coming to enlightenment. And so scholars have studied how did that offensive non-dharmic language come into very important dharmic sutras. Well, how does any of that come into being? Because somebody has anger and hatred and biased views, and is in a position to put that into the common domain. And then it becomes a policy, or it becomes a sutra. And so sometimes we need to recognize what is not part of the sutra, right? Which is not just because it's difficult to understand, but because it's clearly inconsistent, right, with the Buddha's teaching. So we have to deal with that as practitioners. Then, with all of that, now how do we apply that to our practice? Because that's the whole point of all of that. It's not just to study and gain more knowledge and be able to talk about Buddhism. I mean, it can be that, and for some people it is, and that's okay. You know. But within Buddhism, that's not its point. Within Buddhism, it's all, everything, whether it's the teachings, whether it's the language, whether it's art forms, mandalas, images, statues, altars, whatever it is always directing our, trying to direct our attention back to the fundamental. And so how do we bring all of this into our meditation, into our study, into our practice of the precepts, into our cultivating compassion? How do we guide ourselves? We can study for inspiration, and that's an important role that studying the teachings serves. It inspires us. I hope it inspires you. It's how we engage the teachings. We learn what are the teachings, right? What is right view? How, if I, my view is sort of distorted, what is a correct view of the nature of things? We can study to actually challenge ourselves, to rouse ourselves. Sometimes it can rouse us out of complacency. It can arouse us out of arrogance. It helps us to learn how to guide ourselves. It can be a way of affirming. Sometimes if we're practicing well, we can engage a teaching and realize that in that teaching, it affirms something that you have experienced and didn't know you'd experienced. Reading words, we should know the great reality. Maybe some of you have had that experience where suddenly it's given words. Dogen says sometimes we realize before knowing. And so studying can have that role too, which is quite nice. It's encouraging. But again, it's important to not just study what is easy and not just to rely on it feeling, making us feel inspired or encouraged. That's great when that happens. I mean, that is a function. But if we need that to be present, then we're just going to not engage in very important aspects of the Dharma that will help us and that will ultimately inspire, I think, and will provide guidance and understanding. But we have to work at it. We have to be willing to be patient. You know, and to think about how that flows right into our Zazen, where we will experience and encounter things that are difficult, that don't yield right away, but require persistence and perseverance and faith and trust. I think of Buddhist study as, Dharma study as, it's like, you know, it takes us to the edge of a forest or the foot of a great mountain that's heavily wooded. And as we enter, it keeps guiding us while there's still sunlight filtering through the leaves, right? But there's a point when we get deeper and deeper into those woods, deeper into that mountain, where there's no light coming through anymore. And that's when what we've studied drops away. And that's okay, because it's in you. That's why it's so important, I think, to understand how this deep level of language is affecting our perceptions at a pre-conscious level, at a pre-language level. We don't have to hold it in front of us. We don't have to be thinking about something that we've studied, particularly if we've studied it well, deeply, contemplatively. And so that's why the teachings say the way to engage a teaching is to hear it, encounter it, and then reflect. And that's a very important part of it. which means to stop, right? Pause, reflect. What is that saying, right? How do I understand that? Maybe go back to it again. Maybe that passage includes a word that you don't really understand. So you stop and you turn and you try and look, understand what does that term mean? Because this passage seems to depend on that. And so if we're just trying to get through it, you know, sometimes people will just recount all the books that I've read, that they read, and I thought, maybe that's a good thing. Slow. Slow is more. And so there's that point where the light isn't filtering in anymore, and now the consciousness of your study falls away because you don't need to carry it in front of you because it's there. And it's guiding you. It's guiding you in the dark, right? As things are falling away. The senses, self-awareness, thoughts and ideas. Because where you're going is beyond knowing. You can't take those ideas with you. If you take them with you, then you will stop moving, right? Or we will just wander. Or we'll turn around and head back for where there was light, because that was more comforting. So we have to be willing to enter into that place. And then like a distant, dim sense of something that cannot and should not be ultimately put into words begins to come into view in a different kind of way. A view, a knowing, an understanding, an experience. We have these words, but words define. Let's remember that. They tame, they limit, they codify. So none of those words actually correctly expresses what's happening. To talk about realization, that somebody has realized the nature of mind, is true and not true at the same time. Because those words by necessity require a subject and an object. A knower and something that's known. A realizer and something that's been realized. So we can still use those words, but just let's use them knowingly, in a way, carefully. Don't try and bottle it. Don't try and recollect it. Don't try and put it into a narrative that you can't wait to tell your best friend. To find our way, we have to let go of what we have understood. Consciously let go. You don't have to carry it with you. It is not lost. And then at some point, we stop walking. Don't move. Don't move. It's here. It's here. And now the sutras, the teachings, are not sutras anymore. They're not teachings. They're your body and mine. And now they have fulfilled their purpose. If our world is a result of our constructive processes, as the scholar said, then all study, practice, realization is not about deconstructing. Sometimes people use that. It's about deconstructing the self. It's not. There's not a self that needs to be deconstructed. But really realizing the self nature of the constructor and the construction and of the materials that we use. That's why when the Buddha was enlightened, he said, O house builder, he's talking to himself, O house builder, you will build this house no more. And so if language influences perception, and it certainly does, then let that influence be, as we use language, as we study the Dharma, to let us enter more deeply. Not to sit on the surface with knowledge and information, but to enter more deeply into the ground of being. Let it help us to bring forth true compassion. That's a good word to start with, understanding from a Buddhist perspective. That'll keep you busy for a long, long while. Dogen said, when intimate language encounters an intimate person, the Buddha eye sees the unseen. This is the fulfillment of all of the teachings. Intimate action is not known by self or other. The intimate self alone knows it. So here we see this really wondrous, we might even say miraculous, interplay. This gift of human consciousness, this gift of language, it's like magic. And yet, it's like having, like so many things in the human realm, it's like holding something that has so much power, and we hold it like a child. We don't know what we're holding. We just think, oh my God, this is amazing. Let's see what we can do with it. Right? Before we have any inkling of an understanding, not only of it, but of this. And so to really, I think that's one of the things I so appreciate about Buddhism. From the very beginning, the Buddha clearly had a profound understanding of the power of language to do harm. We know this. And of the power for it to bring unimaginable good. I hope we also know this. And we have that within us. So.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.